Hello, and welcome to Label Sessions Presents. Label Sessions is a global platform that connects you to the best advice for the most interesting people. Whether you want advice, mentoring, or ideas. I'm Josh Nix, content producer for Label Sessions. And in this episode, Keisha Kijano of Label Sessions talks to Dominic Campbell. Dominic is a public service entrepreneur and leader, making his name as the founder and CEO of FutureGov, the consultancy that helped bring digital and design into the heart of government transformation. Let's hear more from Dominic and Keisha.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Could you please introduce yourself and expand more on what you do for the Label Sessions audience?
Background is pretty much a government nerd, I would say, originally. Someone who's probably already spent 30 years thinking about being passionate about how I can be a part of government and changing government in particular, which is what I've realized over time. I think from a teenager, felt like that was the place to be for being a social activist, believe it or not, would be local government. Spent time there in London, in city government for the first 5 years of my career, working from policy and then falling in love with sort of technology-led design and change as well in government and seeing the power of tools. Also seeing some of the really awful ways in which old technology and old ways of working was getting in the way of some of the most important jobs in our society, from child protection or looking after the elderly or whatever it might be. And so I think probably that was where my love of design and more 21st century ways of thinking and working came, mostly from saying how not to do it rather than how to do it, to be honest. So left government in 2008, started a company called FutureGov. Never really intended to be an entrepreneur. I think it's probably the classic way these things happen. Thought I would work in government my whole career. Since realized that I was always sort of entrepreneurial with a small e before I became an entrepreneur with a big e. So ran that for 10, 15 years. And then I spent the last few years thinking very much about how to draw on those lessons and advise others in making change happen in large organizations.
Talking about organizational change and innovation in the public sector, how do you create and maintain this 21st century organization that people can genuinely connect with?
It's been a journey. I mean, if you can imagine what 2005 was like, you know, we were sort of 5 years after the dot-com bubble bursting and really very much what you realize now was at the very beginning of practicing what the world was going to look like, I think. I've probably spent 20 years market making in many respects in persuading people that these tools, that these approaches, that user centricity, that experience design, that digital rather than sort of old-fashioned 20th century technology was the way to rewire and bring change to large organizations. And so I mean, the main thing to realize is this is a career's work. It's not a project. It's not even like a 3-year business plan. Like, this is this is what you have to really sort of be committed to long term in order to make change happen in these large institutions. Because, you know, obviously they take a London borough, they spend £500 million every year broadly on a range of different services, and you're then given a relatively meager transformation budget to change direction of what is this huge tanker that is deeply hardwired into Victorian era ways of communicating and ways of working. And so you really need time, you need sort of space given to you by leadership and others who can see that sort of potential and that vision of the future, to be able to give you the space to practice, to prototype, to show success in a very small way, to build belief. Because ultimately, who are you compared to the head of child protection or the head of street scene, or these people who have got very, very serious management jobs to protect some of the most vulnerable people in society, and to put that at risk in their mind by changing. In many ways, the fear of change is inevitably, you know, far greater than the fear of sticking with the status quo, even if you know it's not quite working. So, in many ways, you need that leadership, you need that sort of narrative, that sales pitch in many respects. You need to show how things can be done better and cheaper. And over time, sort of go on that journey of persuasion, success, and replication and scale, I guess.
Do you have a specific focus on what you initially start with, or does it really depend on the context?
Definitely depends on the context. There's the ideal world, obviously. Like, you would love it that every level of the organization is already bought into the concept of change, even if they don't quite know what that means and if they haven't done this before. In this way, you would love it if that was the case. It's very rarely the case. Often you're either brought in by sort of an enthusiastic, frontline-oriented individual or manager who's just got a little budget or a frustration of a thing that they want fixing. But also, through those people, you can start to build a peer network of similarly minded frontline people, is that you can almost get recommended onto. Viewing an organization as a community in that way, I think, is really important to get that sort of peer-to-peer validation and spread. It's very much a community. It's about organizing as much as it is an organization. Like, how do you sort of organize a movement for change? There are other times which comes with benefits when you're invited in by a CEO or a senior leader, but often then come into contact with, perhaps somebody who's a bit more skeptical. You've sort of, circumnavigated the sort of the need end of the spectrum, they might see it as, I didn't ask for this and it's being imposed on me from the top. So it can be good and bad to get that authorization from the top. But then, as I say, in many ways, whether it's people, process, technology, whichever angle you come at it from, ideally all of it together, the approach I've tended to take is always looking at organization design, service or experience design, and technology design simultaneously to try and, demonstrate that, you can't redesign an experience in a hostile environment of an organization that doesn't want to accept that experience design. If they're, steadfastly stuck in old ways of working, of doing business cases, of communicating in very siloed ways, then that sort of almost organ transplant of change isn't going to graft onto the body of the organization. And then technology is obviously fundamental. If a technology has been built for another purpose and yet you're trying to make it work, a sales CRM to be used as child protection case management, it's really problematic. And trying to work out when a sort of tool is usable for a different purpose and when it isn't, and you need to build something appropriate to that space. But ultimately, technology being brilliant at literally coding change, at building a new DNA into the organization that makes that change stick, is really important.
Wow, you have to think about literally, I guess, everything and keep all plates spinning all at once.
I do think that's fundamental. It's having that ideal sort of jigsaw puzzle box of everything that you're trying to get to, but working out where are the opportunities for building the sky or the grass or the house first and building out from there is really important.
How does your advice differ when talking to perhaps companies starting fresh compared to sort of well-established entities who are looking to reinvent their existing structure?
There's the obvious points around the frictionlessness of startups. And it's something that probably has frustrated me through my career when people talk about government as a startup, because it doesn't really exist. Often what they're talking about is recruiting a digital team or a service design team or something, but they're still being dropped into a very hostile environment or an immune system that is whether deliberately or accidentally going to distorts what you're trying to achieve with those new tools just because it's an alien object that they're not used to and don't really know how to interact with. So there's obviously that, sort of major difference. But it's not to say that building organizations from scratch is inherently easier in some respects, because you've got, even in public service, you've got product market fit to think about. You've got almost like the world being your oyster. in terms of opportunity and, you know, the type of product you might be building to solve which problems, based around what business model, you know, trying to make sure that it solves real problems for people when you're not actually in the system of delivery, but actually almost looking in on it from the outside, comes with real challenges of its own. And in some ways, the design constraints, you know, it's a bit Goldilocks. It's like too tight, too loose, just right is kind of what you're aiming for in terms of design constraints, I would say. And if you look at certain social startups, like one I work with, Beam, for instance, in homelessness and employment, like they've got that positioning right of like, how do we find a partner who is willing to sort of trust us enough to get on and build and deliver something 21st century whilst it being connected to their subject matter expertise, their reality check on what is the problem we're trying to solve and how do we best innovate to do that, which gives you the sort of just enough design constraints as a startup. And then equally in an institution, you want to find similar elbow room so that you can actually, you know, find the space to prove the future or demonstrate the future, because so often otherwise it's, you know, imagine how this world might be. And they're like, well, that's all well and good, but over here it might be a bit ineffective, but at least it's real. And you're asking me to trust you and be creative versus just deliver something that's a bit crap but does the job. And you really need to try as far as you can to get to something that's tangible to be able to give people the confidence and the backing to be able to say, okay, there's enough here for me to go with this and try it out.
When advising organizations on their tech approaches, how do you integrate the other parts, so like change management and this kind of design? And how do you get the entity to consider the broader aspects, service experience, design, organization? How do you get them to go beyond just isolated technology solutions to achieve more holistic change?
Absolutely. And it's surprising to me in some respects, or maybe I shouldn't be surprised that in 2024 that is still very much the case. And it's almost become more so since the pandemic, I would say, where, you know, people have implemented Teams, which they didn't have before because they suddenly had to work remotely. And they've almost, you know, almost paused in their sort of organizational development. They've said like, okay, we're digital now, we've got this, rather than just actually that's the foundations you perhaps should have had in 2010 or 2015. And really everything else that you're describing is actually what this is about ultimately. And the same is coming through with AI and a whole range of other things, where yes, it's a really good can opener. It's a really good entry point to look at needing new tools for solving whichever problem or modernizing. But I think for me, a lot of the time it is around self-awareness. And it isn't just that people come at it from technology. They might come at it from a policy that a minister has come up with and they're not thinking about technology or how to do delivery. They're just making an announceable for the minister that they're going to be spending some money. Or they might be coming at it from an organizational change perspective where they want to change different things for employees without actually thinking about what technology or service experience do we need on top of that. And so I think the crucial thing is whichever angle people are coming at it from, giving them that wider perspective and helping them understand that, you know, fine, as long as you're self-aware about where you are on the journey, about what you're doing, but can see the whole landscape that you may be wanting to consider over time. I think that's the crucial piece, because so much advice and so much work that is undertaken does remain in those swim lanes of a systems replacement project or a HR policy improvement program or whatever it might be. And so I think giving that sort of neutral, trusted advice and wider perspective is fundamental for people to be able to see what else is possible out there.
What point in discussion journey are you bringing up this more zoom out look into it? Do you do it from the very beginning, or is it as you're having discussions?
For me, it's got to be always there. It's always in your back pocket. I think that's the thing about, you know, I realize I've always been in sales to some degree. I was a policy person in government and then I ran a consultancy. And what I realized was actually that's always about narrative, vision, storytelling, selling people on a vision of the future, basically, and giving them the the horizon that they might be aiming for. And I think if you're not doing that from quite an early stage, even if it's in pencil, even if it's only very light and broad, even if it's like one slide of your 100-slide technology modernization thing initially, I think it's really important that people have that sort of North Star really early on. But I think the important thing is like tailoring that to the stakeholders, because quite often the sort of CEOs tend to be drawn to that. What is all this about? What's the bigger picture? But often people who are in delivery end of the spectrum, I'm just like, that's great, but I just need my problem solved here and now. And so I think getting that right and having the right message at the right time for the right people is super important in terms of trying to help orchestrate and cajole and manifest that wider strategy and vision, I guess.
What advice would you give to organizations who want to keep evolving and want to prevent stagnation?
It's so crucial, and it's really problematic for so many. I mean, if you look at the nonprofit charity sector, it's extremely hard for most of those outside of the top 10 charities, say, where the kind of wiggle room you have organizationally internally is so limited. There's a version of that in government where you have this sort of revenue capital split of budgets, where revenue's under enormous pressure in terms of headcount versus capital, a bit more flexibility to buy stuff and things, which will often be a sort of one-off IT project that you can go out and buy for implementation. But it really is fundamental, and I think a lot more organizations and organizational leaders are realizing that we're probably, and it's not just a public sector thing, I see it in, I don't know, I'm currently doing some work in academia with Georgetown, like, you know, you can see people bottoming out and realizing that the sort of hollowing out of internal capacity has gone too far. And without that, there is no real way to create that sustainability of organizational development that you're describing there. So it is, but I think the challenge is also one I've seen is quite hard coded in things like business case documentation, believe it or not. Like, you know, if there's a spreadsheet written in a certain way that gets you to articulate the world in a certain fashion, and really it's all on a 1-year horizon or an 18-month horizon or a, you know, rather than, and also is only thinking about the cost of technology, for instance, not what is the time saved, the improvement in recruitment, the retention ability that comes with this change program, then the budget is always going to be smaller than the reality. There is a far bigger impact, a far bigger pot to play with, the bigger the sort of, you've got to get it again a bit just right and right sizing it. You don't want to be saying that we're going to flip the whole organization upside down, but you equally don't want to just say we're going to change our email technology. It's got to be somewhere in between those two perspectives that can say, which is why I'm so committed to service design and experience design, to say, you know, if you look at UK government, it wasn't to change the servers on which people were managing the passport service. It was the create a, apply for a passport service as a whole, which gives you a much bigger pot to play with, a much larger service to reorientate. And then the business case for long-term sustainable delivery, investing in continuous improvement, becomes a lot more straightforward. It's also one of the most controversial bits I found as well. Like, you know, I was chief digital officer of an organization in government for a while, and from all the conversations and discussions that we had over that period, the one that took longest was trying to get people to right size, like, what are our services? Like, what do we actually deliver? And actually name them in very simple terms. And there was a belief that there was something like 48 of them in this organization. But by the end of the year, we'd got it down to 4, because actually we just had them in the, you know, we were really describing like policy agendas or what teams do, rather than actually what is the citizen experience, what services are they consuming, how do they think about what we do and what we could do for them. And once you flip it in that way, it becomes a lot more straightforward to understand the right size of, you know, what is it we deliver and how do we describe that.
This podcast is brought to you by Label Sessions, the global platform that connects you to the best advice from the most interesting people. Around the world, we work with brands to connect their people to true leaders, just like the people you hear on this podcast, for live sessions of advice, mentoring, or sometimes to collaborate on ideas. To find out more, visit labelsessions.com and book in for a demo with our team.
with all of this talk about change and, again, this organizational design, it would be great if we could quickly touch on the culture transformation part of it as well. What insights into the tools and strategy that you use to address modern challenges? What should we start thinking about now? But also, what should we stop thinking about?
I think a lot of the culture of change is around moving us into a world of hearts and minds rather than just minds. I think so much of the work that's been done, and where we get stuck in the modernization rather than transformation trap, is that everything's based on hyper tangible, like, you know, how was this done before? Where are the examples of success that I can copy? You know, where, give me a promise of the budget and the output over what exact period of time? And I think one of the best developments over the last 5 or 10 years is people moving into a place where we're moving beyond delusion in some ways. Like, the way I describe it is, like, it's much better to be sort of self-aware about where you are as an organization and where you're heading, because that gives you, like, you know possible success, compared to if you're not quite sure where you are, but you want promise on where you're going, it's almost certainly going to lead to failure. And I think for me, like, that agile way of working, that sort of realistic mindset that moves us beyond very rigid budget structures, promises, but actually gets the right balance between, you know, I'm a process addict, but it's got to be the right process. It's got to be, you know, regular, like, small communications. It's got to be about, you know, epic mindsets that think about things in 3 to 6 month periods that are broken down into small tasks, not this sort of, give me £100 million that'll, you know, deliver exactly X on the 1st of May 2029, because we all know that that just never was a reality, and we were deluding ourselves. So I think there's that. I also think, like, really falling in love with imagination and possibility, and really, you know, thinking through, like, what is it that we could be like, and giving people examples and experiences that can help them feel it and believe it. Because so much of the conversation around change is that tangible side, and so often you're trying to persuade or win an argument to make change happen based on, like, faith, it feels to people, and the gap in that narrative to me is, like, how can I persuade somebody of what a 21st century organization is if they've never experienced it firsthand? You know, almost everybody I know in government and other organizations have never worked in an organization that has been created post 2000. Like, it is always an organization that predates this millennium, that is modernizing and just putting a sedimentary layer of modern experience or technology on top of broken, old-fashioned approaches. And so for me, I think a lot of it is getting people out there and getting them to feel what the future can be, not just think, because, you know, there's this gap between heart and mind otherwise, which I think doesn't get us where we need to get to.
100%. And also, when you're having that conversation where they can imagine this end point being, when that comes to life within the strategy, then they have that buy-in of, like, yeah, that was also my idea. I can see that in my head. I've got that emotion attached to it. I want to do that, not, oh, it's happened in the past. I guess it's success that happened, so there's no other excuse than we have to make this work. Like, that can't just be the emotional drive behind it.
I think so much of it is again, like, what organization do you want to be when you grow up? Like, what do you want to be known for? What do you want to be responsible for? Like, which bits of this world that's emerging still, because we're still very early on in much of it, is, it feels right to you and relates to you? Like, you know, the government organization I talked about earlier, when we were talking about who do you want to be, we never talked about another government organization. We always talked about, do you want to be, you know, Tinder? Do you want to be Auto Trader? Do you want to be Airbnb or something else? Like, which of these experiences and feelings and sort of you know, service orientations? Do you want to take your organization down? What do you want it to feel like at the end of the day? Not how do you cover your ass by copying something that's been deemed to be okay by another government regulator, sort of thing. Like, I would hope meeting statutory requirements and not acting illegally would be the sort of baseline of any design process of an institution. But beyond that, let's take that for granted and we'll do that. But beyond that, how do you want your organization to manifest itself in the world? And how do you unlock that bit of people's brain that goes beyond process management into experience design?
Great. Well, for our end bit of our podcast, we've had a lot about your ideas, some teasers on the bits of advice that you could give other people. We also want to learn just a little bit about you and who you are. So we have a few quick fire questions to ask. Could you describe your desk for our audience?
Nomadic, which is code for I don't really have a desk. Right now I have a DJ set on it, I would say. I've got a mixing desk, which is what I'm working off right now. So yeah, classic work environment, let's say.
What is a piece of advice that you would like to give, if you could, to a younger you?
I think the best piece of advice I probably ever had was to really understand what is within your control and what is outside of your control, and be very clear about that, and understanding what's at the core of ultimately what matters, you know, friends, family, whatever. But I think then beyond that, really being clear about where you're getting distracted by things that ultimately you can only influence and can't actually directly control. I spend a lot of time in the wrong space, I would say, through my career.
In another life, what would your career be?
Well, I kind of pointed to it with what was on my desk, I guess. So I used to enjoy DJing a huge amount and still follow many DJs on Instagram with envy. But in the real world, the other path that I was going to take, as someone who's hugely committed to social justice, was actually to become a barrister. So that would probably be the grown-up career, other than DJing, that I would have loved to have had.
If you're benevolent dictator, what would the first thing that you would do, or the first order that you would give be?
I think it would be housing. I would probably focus on making sure that everybody everywhere just had that taken off the table. We talk very much about universal basic income and other things, but I find the use of housing as a proxy for wealth problematic, and feels like one of those basics that if we could take that off the table for everybody, then the world would be a fundamentally different place. So yeah, that would be where I would start.
My last question is a question that we ask everyone here on the podcast. Dol, on a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you?
Definitely depends on the day of the week and time of the day. I would probably say, I'm going to answer on behalf of my internal monologue, and I would say probably 8.
With that, that wraps up today's episode. Thank you so much for joining us and for giving us your insights and a taster of the advice that you could give.
You too. Thanks so much. It's been great.
So concludes another episode of Label Sessions Presents. Be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast no matter your platform of choice. And of course, start your journey today with us at labelsessions.com.